I want you to know that my feelings are deep today, not simply because my own oldest child sets out on a voyage of discovery here at BYU that will shape and affect his life forever, but also because with each passing year, and this is our fifth with you, you all seem more and more like my children. I actually get butterflies in my stomach when school approaches. When I see you swarming back on campus around Labor Day, I feel just like the mother who waits and watches and finally sees her children drive up for Thanksgiving or for Christmas or Easter or the 4th of July. And the nice thing about BYU is that every day with you is a little like Thanksgiving and Christmas and Easter and the 4th of July all rolled into one, especially the 4th of July part. But Jeff and I do want you to know that we do love you and we take our family relationship with you very seriously. Now, I don't want to embarrass you any more than we have embarrassed Matt by conveying an in loco parentis attitude. But we do sense some obligation to think and act and worry about you in the absence of your own parents. So, forgive a mother's doting today as I fuss over your meals and straighten your clothing and ask if you've done your homework. May I express that love to you with one short story and one word of encouragement for the new year. Several years ago, we were in a small group with President and Sister Ann Eldon Tanner. They have always been so kind to us ever since Jeff served under his direction while President Tanner lived in England as president of the West European Mission. In this social setting, they asked us how our children were doing, and I said something foolish like, "Well, they're just fine. They're just not old enough yet to get into any difficulty." And President Tanner sat back and laughed and said, "That reminds me of what I used to say to my girls when they were old enough to get into difficulty." He said, "As their dates came for them, and as they were about to leave the house, I would see them out the door and say, 'Good night, kids. Have fun and be good.'" They said that always perturbed them and that I should make up my mind one way or the other whether I wanted them to have fun or to be good. Now, I want you this year to have fun and study hard and love the why and be good. Excuse me. I especially want you to be good. Have you ever stopped to think about how often we use the word good in the course of the day? We say good morning. We tell our family, friends, and acquaintances to have a good day. We wish people we like good luck. And we say of people we don't like, good riddance. We have good times and good cheer, good food, good fun. We sing of the good old summertime, the good ship lollipop. And here's one for all of you Beach Boy fans, good, good, good vibrations. Our parents tell us of the good old days, you know, walking 10 miles to school in a blizzard, uphill, both ways. Someone we admire is a good egg, and of course when our day ends, whether or not it was, we say good night. Well, BYU is a good place to be. Furthermore, I know you want to be good, and that's half the battle already won. It is said that by desiring what is perfectly good, even when we don't quite know what it is and cannot do what we would, we are part of the divine power against evil, widening the skirts of light and making the struggle with darkness narrower. May I just repeat that? I believe it is a profound and very encouraging thought. By desiring what is perfectly good, even when we do not know quite what it is and cannot do what we would, we are part of the divine power against evil, widening the skirts of light and making the struggle with darkness narrower. The Lord does allow darkness, and He allows struggle and pain. He often uses it to call us to Him. Using my own children as examples, I've come to know that the one who is playing happily is so preoccupied with pleasant experiences that he sometimes may not respond when I call and may even run farther away. But the child who has been hurt or who is in pain seeks me out, comes readily, knocks at my door, if you will, is anxious for me to help, and he is healed. Can you make the transition of this motherly concern I have for every one of you to the perfect parental concern of heaven? And even if such a call from him seems as faint as the stroke of a dove's wing, respond to it and ask, what would you have me do? In personal, private communion with God, I promise you, all of you here, that the light in you will widen and darkness will grow more narrow. That which may have been depressed in you will move, and you will be lifted above your troubles to embrace God's love. I bear testimony of that love, and with it, you will have a good year. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.
Obviously, part of the purpose of this very first hour together is just to have fun, to sing the songs. My compliments to our choir and chorus and to the congregation, to the band, greatest pep band in the world. It's fun to be here to laugh a little together, but I find myself at this point wishing selfishly that I had 2 or 3 hours just to consider what I think a new year might mean together for us. Once in my life, when I was about your age, I wished I had money. Now I'm older and wiser and still about as poor. And I wish now far more desperately for time. What you do with your time in these next few months will matter infinitely more to you than any financial investment you could make and what it would mean for your bank account. On that subject of your time, may I do something here I have never done before in this setting. I simply now make a strong personal plea for your attendance at our forum and devotional series here in the Marriott Center every Tuesday at 11. That weekly alternating series is one of the richest traditions we have at Brigham Young University. I know of no university in the nation, literally, that offers twice a month, every month as we do, for the rich general education of its faculty and its students, the visit of truly distinguished men and women, leaders in art and science and government and letters, including some of our own finest faculty members here. As for our devotional assemblies, obviously there is no place, including in Salt Lake City itself, where every other week of the academic year, a general authority of the church prepares and delivers a major message of interest and inspiration. Given the growth of the church now, most members will see a general authority perhaps once a year at one state conference. Yet we're privileged at BYU to have them at least twice a month, plus the 15 state fireside, and sometimes more than that, every month of the year. Now, attendance at both of these events has been steadily and persistently declining for 10 years. In the name of intellectual curiosity and spiritual renewal, I ask you to attend. If attendance continues to decline, the future of the series is obviously in jeopardy. To cease holding them would be an immense loss to all of us here and certainly to the students who will come after us. Please make this an important hour on your weekly educational calendar. Thank you for allowing me to ask that of you. Now, it is traditional in this very first assembly of the year for the president to run down a laundry list of items. This has to be something of a business meeting regarding your responsibilities while at school. Included on that list has always been something about dress and grooming. I wish to make a historic departure today and not speak about dress and grooming. Hold your applause. I do that simply because, for the most part, I think you have looked absolutely splendid this year. I compliment you for that, and I ask you to continue to take pride in clean, modest dress and inappropriate grooming. I should note, however, that shorts do seem to be popular this year, and we're seeing a few too many of them on campus. Any is too many. New wave is still around, so be careful not to push that to excess. But I love the return of the crew cut. I went all through BYU with a crew cut, and that was only 57 years ago. At BYU, we like very cautious progress on such matters. So I congratulate you. You do, in fact, look magnificent. I'm grateful for what that says about you and what it says about you. Thank you very, very much. That's all we're going to say about dress and grooming. Far more important are the truly substantial issues of your honor, indeed those of the honor code, which deal with character and integrity. I have here in my hand letters that I have received this year. They are the 12 or 15 or 20 that I get every year on this subject. I wish to refer to just two of them this morning. Inasmuch as this one on the top is from a very recent student, you will realize that the first sentence caught my eye rather quickly. It says, "Here is the $700 I owe the scholarship program." The letter then notes that a scholarship for this student was an absolute must to be able to attend BYU. But although the high school grade point average was relatively high, the first taking of the ACT exam did not bring a score that would have guaranteed a scholarship. Then, during the crucial second taking of the exam, a friend offered some answers to a question, and you know the rest of the story. "I didn't know how much this would come back to haunt me," he says. "I love the Y, but I came here the wrong way. I hope this money will allow some deserving student to come the right way." Now, this other letter, a second, hand-typed, I've underlined it in red, is from a woman who attended BYU in the 1930s. That's 50 years ago, give or take a year or two. What does that make her in age? 70 or 75, I guess. She writes, "This past year we've been trying to put our lives in order. I need to confess something to you. During the time I attended BYU, I worked in such and such a department. The wage in those years was 25 cents an hour." We don't change quickly in that area either. The wage in those years was 25 cents an hour. "I needed the money. It was the Depression. And on a few days, I indicated on my time card that I worked more overtime than I had." Now listen to this incredible next paragraph. "In talking this over with my husband, we decided that I probably could have worked 2 hours a day through the week and maybe four on Saturday. I worked also part of two summers. But on the safe side, I added hours for all the summer months. All in all, we figured that it could have been possible, at the very most, to earn $357 in total wages for the entire time I was at BYU. Now, the amount I cheated on could only have been a few dollars, but I am returning everything. Enclosed is a check for $357. This is a difficult letter to write," she concludes. "I am ashamed and a very humbled person, and I ask you on behalf of BYU to accept this restitution, and I pray for your forgiveness." A 70 or 75-year-old woman for 50 years worrying about that. These happen to be some of the moral issues that we can talk with you about here quite comfortably. Obviously, it isn't as comfortable to talk about the far more personal, and I think it's fair to say far more destructive abuses, sexual and otherwise, that can and do haunt some at this university. But these letters at least give us a very visible place to begin, a comfortable point on which surely no one can disagree. Honesty, integrity, character, virtue. Those are marvelous words in the BYU vocabulary, and I pray they always will be. I thank these people for writing, caring enough to share it with us so that we might learn. I ask you to use their example and do your own best work. Earn your own success here. If you quote from someone else in a paper or a presentation, give credit. Be courteous. Live within the rules. Be disciplined and devout. Be kind. Live together in love. Try to understand what Robert Frost meant when he said freedom was moving easily in the harness. What does any of this have to do with an education and the first day of school? Well, everything. Ortega y Gasset, the man who for me is the most gifted and persuasive Spanish voice of the 20th century, said of education, and specifically of university education, "In history as in life, possibilities do not become realities of their own accord. Someone, with his hands and his brain, with his labor and his self-sacrifice, must make realities of them. All we are given is the possibility to make ourselves one thing or another. But slovenliness, if that helps you understand why we see a link between dress and grooming and academic life, slovenliness penetrates our whole national life from top to bottom. To oppose slovenliness, the individual must go into training and give up some things in the determination to surpass himself. A generation who will do that can accomplish what centuries failed to do without it. And here, my young friends, lies your challenge. I'm still quoting. Yours is the historic task of restoring to the university its cardinal function of enlightenment. In the thick of life's urgencies and its passions, the university must assert itself as a major spiritual power, standing for serenity in the midst of frenzy, for seriousness and the grasp of intellect in the face of unashamed stupidity. Then the university, once again, will come to be what it was in its grand hour, an uplifting principle in the history of the Western world. It's a long quote, but it seems to me a magnificent one. And I hope it will matter to you. Brigham Young University's grand hour has not yet come. But if we want it badly enough, and we'll work for it, then BYU will, like Zion herself, rise up and put on her beautiful garments. We don't speak much about Zion anymore, but those old-timers did. And they kept on searching for it, from New York to Pennsylvania to Ohio to Missouri to Illinois to the Great Basin West. Whatever else Zion was, then or now, it was a place where good people with pure hearts could gather in common purpose to love God and their neighbor while pursuing eternal truth. Now, a cross-cultural, rapidly growing, multinational church can't speak of Zion quite as easily today as it once did in Jackson County or Nauvoo or even the Salt Lake Valley. Of necessity, now we speak of multiple Zions, of remaining pure in heart in the far reaches of the world, where perhaps only the scriptural two or three are gathered in His name. But a little glimpse of that older, original idea could and should remain here. Is it possible that this campus represents the one remaining city, if you will, where 35,000 of the young and the old, male and female, new convert and longtime member, have chosen to gather, to voluntarily live together as a community founded on gospel principles in what could, if we made it so, be very much like those of the ancients who sought to bring forth Zion, that it might rejoice upon the hills and flourish? Close quote. Now, what the start of school does for me each year is declare that one shining symbol of that age-old quest is still alive and well on 600 acres of land nestled beneath Y Mountain in Provo, Utah. And once more, we have a chance to hold some things in common, indeed to hold them sacred, while we pursue truth and celebrate virtue in our own little 35,000-strong United Order. Now, may I conclude this morning with two stories that are very different, about two different aspects of what we share here. The first experience is 130 years old. It will be familiar to many of you. It is a favorite of mine, and I've chosen to share it. It happened to the grandmother of Sister Marjorie Hinckley, wife of Gordon B. Hinckley, second counselor in the First Presidency of the Church. Having left their home and possessions in England in order to move west by handcart, this family, and with its 13-year-old scribe, writes of that mother's determination and of their journey, including the almost immediate death and burial of the family's youngest child, 2 years of age. We pick up her diary immediately after that funeral. We traveled from 15 to 25 miles a day till we got to the Platte River. We caught up with the handcart companies that day, and we watched them cross the river. There were great lumps of ice floating down it. It was bitter cold. The next morning there were 14 dead. We went back to camp and had our prayers and sang, Come, come ye saints, no toil nor labor fear. I wondered what made my mother cry that night. The next morning my little sister was born. It was the 23rd of September. We named her Edith. She lived 6 weeks, and then she died. She was buried at the last crossing of the Sweetwater. When we arrived at Devil's Gate, it was bitter cold. We left many of our things there. My brother James was as well as ever he was when he went to bed that night. In the morning, he was dead. My feet were frozen, also my brother's and my sister's. It was nothing but snow. We could not drive the pegs in our tents. We did not know what would become of us. And then one night a man came to our camp and told us that Brigham Young had sent men and teams to help us. Well, we sang songs and danced and we cried. But my mother never got well. She died between the Little and the Big Mountains. She was 43 years of age. We arrived in Salt Lake City. Remember, there's a 13-year-old girl. We arrived in Salt Lake City, 9 o'clock at night, the 11th of December, 1856. 3 out of the 4 that were living were frozen. My mother was dead in the wagon. The doctor amputated my toes while the sisters were dressing mother for her grave. That afternoon, she was buried. I have often thought of my mother's words before we left England. "Polly," she said, "I want to go to Zion. I want to go while my children are small. I want them raised in the gospel of Jesus Christ." That's part of the price that others have paid for you and for me to be in this room this day. It is part of the reason we ask you to study like you've never studied in your life and to live with Christian commitment. Too many children and too many mothers paid too high a price for Zion to have us muff our far easier and more compelling chance now. The second experience is very different. It is only 9 days old. As a rule, I suppose football would not seem to be part of any discussion for establishing Zion. I spend most of my time here trying to restrain our enthusiasm for football or whatever. But hear me out. Coach Edwards told me something last week that deeply touched me. It obviously touched him. As the team was returning to Provo about 2 o'clock in the morning following the Pitt game, he and Patty, sitting in the bus, could not help overhearing two of his players talking in the seat just behind them. I won't identify them because I think this is very personal, though I expect they would allow me to if I chose to. They were not talking about beating a traditional powerhouse like Pitt. They were not talking about how the offense had sparkled and how the defense had dug in. They were not talking about a conference championship, nor an undefeated season, nor a national ranking. They were talking about the one player's recent baptism into the church, along with his wife, who is also a student athlete here. He spoke of his eager anticipation of receiving the priesthood and of a future sealing in the temple. Indeed, there seemed to be only one real disappointment in this whole conversation, and it wasn't about the ball game. It was that this young man had not known, and therefore had not joined the church early enough to be able to serve a mission. At that, the other player, in reply, spoke of how much his mission had meant to him, how it had given real direction to his life. Now, much of this young man's life had been spent without a father in the home. I know him. I happen to know what it meant to his mother to have him bear the priesthood and to serve a mission. Now, Coach and Sister Edward said they had a little trouble fighting down the lump in their throat, thinking of these 260-pound behemoths sitting behind them, kids who eat steel girders for breakfast and concrete slabs for lunch, talking quietly after one of BYU's greatest football victories ever of baptism and priesthood and mission and temples and of BYU. I dare say these are not standard discussion topics with any other football team in America. Now, another young man in that bus played marvelously well against Pitt and contributed directly to our victory. He took a real beating that afternoon, and even a Helaman Hall's bed must have looked good to him by the time he hit that pillow at about 2:30 or 3 that early that Sunday morning. But his branch president, with whom I have some ecclesiastical responsibility, told me that he was up bright and early the next morning at church on time. When President Uluavi expressed some momentary surprise at his presence, this rock-solid young man, with thighs the size of tree stumps, said simply, "I'm a priest. We have only 3 in the branch. I wasn't sure who'd be here to bless the sacrament." "When we conclude to make Zion," said Brigham Young, "we'll make it. And the work will commence in the heart of each person. I have Zion in my view constantly," he said. "We're not going to wait for angels or for Enoch to come and build it, but we're going to build it ourselves." The need for us to invest our time wisely and to learn with discipline and integrity toward this great goal is my dream for BYU. For such unique reasons as these just cited, education here is a moral issue, and all of us need to be committed to the task. To paraphrase Dante slightly, the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in time of moral crisis, maintain their neutrality. Don't be neutral. Commit everything you have to your educational experience with all the Latter-day Saint significance that has for us here. Your opportunity for growth at BYU, if not a moral crisis, is at least a moral issue. Immerse yourself in the privilege which is yours, so that, to quote Egasset, "in the thick of life's urgencies and its passions, we can grasp the intellect and assert ourselves as a major spiritual power, an uplifting principle in the Western world." Welcome back to school. Work hard. Have fun. Be good. We love you. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.